And welcome back to the Offspring Magazine, the podcast. It's Bea, and I will be hosting today's podcast. Today, I will talk to Dr. Giulio Malavolta, who is a group leader at the MPI for Security and Privacy in Bochum and head of the Cryptography Systems Group. Today is part one of our conversation. We talk about quantum computers. What are quantum computers? How are they different from classical computers? What are they being used for? What is the theory behind quantum computers? And much more. But don't worry, the conversation is not very technical, as I'm definitely no expert in this field, and I'm also completely new, so don't be discouraged from listening to this conversation. So with that, please enjoy my conversation with Giulio Malavolta. Thank you so much for joining us today. Why don't we just start by having you introduce yourself and tell us what you do.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. So I'm Giulio, and I currently am a faculty at the Max Planck Institute for Security and Privacy in Bochum. So here I have a research group that is working on theoretical aspects of cryptography, and we are doing research at the intersection between cryptography, quantum computing, and other applications of the mathematics of cryptography. So that's what we're doing here.
You seem quite young. So did you just start out as an academic? And what did you do during your PhD and your postdoc?
So I am not as young as I look. I think I'm older than I look.
But compared to the normal Max Planck Society researcher, you're definitely a lot younger.
I see. So I finished my PhD in 2019 in FAU Erlangen Nuremberg, after that I did 2 years of postdoc. I had a fellowship at the Simons Institute for the Theory of Computing in Berkeley, and then I stayed at UC Berkeley and Carnegie Mellon University. I had a joint appointment there. And in 2020, I joined the MPI, the Max Planck Society, as a faculty here.
And your background, like your bachelor, was in computer science?
No, actually my bachelor was in biology.
Oh, wait, what?
Yeah, it's a little bit of a strange.
This is very strange, but this is very interesting.
Yeah.
So you did a bachelor in biology, and then your master?
In bioinformatics.
Right, so what is bioinformatics then?
So bioinformatics, well, so this was a long time ago, so you shouldn't ask me too many questions about it.
Right, okay.
But bioinformatics is essentially computability aspects of biological processes and everything that surrounds biology, but it has some sort of usable computer, like statistical analysis and
Right. So could I kind of compare? So I'm a chemist. Mm-hmm. I do organic chemistry, but I also do I use density functional theory, which is kind of quantum mechanical simulation of atoms, basically, to kind of help predict the way my chemical reactions are going to work. Is that kind of something
similar-ish? I think it's related. I don't think there's one unified definition of bioinformatics. I think it's more the computer science or mathematical statistical techniques that have applications in anything that concerns biological.
Okay, so master is bioinformatics, and then PhD?
Then, of course, I was lacking a little bit of background in CS. Yeah. So I did another master in CS, and then I started my PhD in CS.
In computer science. Was it hard to do a master's in computer science without having had done a bachelor?
It was a little awkward at the beginning because there was a lot of basic, maybe foundational knowledge that I was lacking.
Yeah.
But I would say it was a little bit more work at the beginning, but once you catch up, then it was normal hard. Hard for as much as it's hard for everyone else.
Right. That's really interesting. I was always actually curious about the switch, how easy it is to switch from a science background to computer science.
if you hadn't done a bachelor, but seems like it is possible if you really want it.
Yeah, so I should say that that it was not like a very abrupt transition, in the sense that the fact that I did bioinformatics and master's, that really helped, because it filled a lot of gaps in my knowledge, and then of course whatever I was missing I picked up when I did my master's in CS.
Okay, so, and now we're here. Okay, so let's start by talking about quantum computers.
Let's start with
that. I think a lot of people actually don't know what quantum computers are. I would assume like 50% of the population doesn't even know that quantum computers are a thing. Do you agree with that?
That about the assessment of the
market? Like that around, that so many people don't know that quantum computers are even a thing.
I would say yes. I think it is an emerging technology which still needs to pick up a little bit of momentum with the general public. Right. So should I maybe say?
I'm just gonna move the microphone closer to you. Actually, no. It's because I'm really loud.
Okay.
And so yes. Yeah, so start by explaining to us what quantum computers are.
Right. So, well, I think maybe to explain what quantum computers are, one maybe has to try to set back and think of what actually classical computers are.
That's a good idea. Right. Yeah.
So, by the way, one kind of technical jargon that we use a lot in this area is, whenever we say classical, that means non-quantum, right? So when I say classical,
so our phones,
exactly, like our phones, the iPad, our laptop, it's everything classical, right? So all these things that we are used to in like, we are also classical human beings. We do classical things, we're non-quantum process, right? So everything is non-quantum. It's called classical. So what is a classical computer? Well, it's just a machine that enables computation, right? Of course, that does computation automatically. Now, the question that you can ask is, what's the physical process that enables this computation? And, whatever is in the classical computer, I don't know. I'm not an expert in hardware, but I presume there's some sort of transistors that is doing some computation, right? Now, the question that people ask with quantum computers is, can we use physical processes at the quantum atomic level to actually perform the computation itself? And so I would say maybe like the one line summary is that quantum computer is a computer that sort of leverages the laws of quantum mechanics to perform computation. So we sort of hack into the quantum structure of nature and try to use this structure to perform some computation for us. And that's maybe quantum computers. Now, as for the physical implementation of quantum computers, there are different ways to do it, but what is important for us is the underlying mathematical model, which is always the same for all this.
For every kind of
quantum computer. Okay. Yes.
So with mathematical model, what exactly do you mean by that? Is that an equation or?
No, so in the same way as we have a mathematical model for classical computing, which is just the Turing model, right? The Turing machine.
Right.
We have the same thing for quantum computers. So we have something called quantum Turing machines, or if you're more of a electrical engineering kind of person, you want to think of circuits. As much as there are classical circuits, with wires and switches and logical gates, there is such a thing as quantum circuits. They work a little bit different from classical circuits, but you can define it. It's a well-defined mathematical model, and you can work with that.
Okay, and then that's used in the quantum computers.
That's what we use to study and understand quantum computing. And what supposedly this machine that engineers are building today will be based their computation on.
Okay. So you said that traditional computers, do you know how traditional computers work? Like how exactly the transistors work there?
At the hardware level?
Yeah.
No, it's not.
No. Okay.
We work with math, so it's not my area.
Right. It seems like quantum computers, there's still a lot of research that's going into it. How established are they, quantum computers?
So I think maybe there are two sides to this question. So there's the theoretical side, which is how established is the model and how well we understand the model. of quantum computing, and there is the aspect of, you know, what's the status of actually building a quantum computer, right? So as for the first part, I would say the model is very well understood. So it's based on, you know, physics that has been developed at the beginning, you know, of the last century, and by now it's sort of a really well established mathematical model. As for building actual quantum computers that work, well, that's an open problem. So it's people are still working on that. So when you translate math to the real world, there are always problems,
yeah.
And sometimes you have to update the math. So
yeah.
Far, we didn't have to do it, but we may need to in the future. We don't know.
Was there the same kind of lag for traditional computers that maybe you had the models and the math, like you say, to it, but it was very hard to actually build a traditional computer or classical computer? Or is this something that's unique to quantum computing?
So there are certain aspects that are sort of unique to quantum computers. So the classical model of computation was established by Turing in his, you know, seminal paper, and it hasn't changed ever since. So
mm-hmm.
that's still the same model. Maybe people have refined it a little and so on. They've built on top of it, but the basic foundations, they're still the same. What happened with classical computer was that it was not so clear at the beginning the scalability of how scalable this technology would be, right, in terms of how much computation you can do with a computer.
Mm-hmm.
But during the process of building computers, there has been a series of technological breakthrough, like for example the invention of the transistors, of integrated
yeah.
circuits, and this kind of hardware breakthrough that allowed to really scale the classical computer to an extent which people did not expect maybe 50 years ago. So it's actually very hard to predict how the progress will go. And we could expect the same to happen for quantum computers. Maybe one difference with respect to classical computers is that we don't expect, in classical computers, we didn't expect anything to go wrong with the physics.
Mm-hmm.
Here we are touching upon very foundational principles of physics, which are also at the interface between things that we don't really understand well. So for example, how the classical world interacts with the quantum world. This is
right.
something we don't understand very well.
Just, I feel like we haven't defined it, and I know it's very hard to define, but can you try to define the quantum world, like what it means to work at a quantum level?
A quantum level.
Yeah.
Right. So defining the difference between what is classical and what is quantum is a very difficult question.
Yeah.
And especially, you know, having a theory that unifies these two notions, it's an open problem in physics, so we don't really have a good answer for that. But what I can say is that there is a theory, there are two different theories that apply depending on which world you live in. So if I'm living in the classical world, there is the theory of classical mechanics, of general relativity, right? That these are things that maybe on a smaller scale, just Newtonian mechanics is what we see every day, right? Whereas if you go on a microscopic scale, then there's a different set of rules that apply, and particles and you know, entities behave in a different way. So, you know, you may ask, when does something stop being quantum and starts becoming
mm-hmm.
classical? That's a difficult question that I don't know how to answer.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody knows how to
yeah.
answer. But maybe the definition of something classical versus something quantum is whether this object, this body, is behaving according to the laws of classical mechanics or the laws of quantum mechanics. And again, like all of our classical computers, they all obey the law of classical mechanics, so there is very little interaction with quantum mechanics. Whereas with quantum computers, we are really hoping to use those interactions in a productive sense. That's maybe the...
So why did we want to build quantum computers?
So what's the origin? What was the original motivation? Or what was the motivation?
Well, I guess if there's been a change between the original motivation and now, then it'd be interesting to know how that
right.
has evolved.
Right, right. So I think the question started. Well, I hope I'm not saying anything wrong, but I think the question really started with the physicist Richard Feynman, that just, you know, maybe out of intellectual curiosity asked, well, can we actually, you know, construct computers that use quantum subatomic rules to do the computation? And I think the reason why he was mostly interested in is to do things like simulation of quantum processes. It's when you want to simulate a quantum process on a computer, it's probably not that unintuitive to understand that a quantum computer will be better than this, just because it's actually running this process inside of the machine rather than sort of trying to...
Right. Can I ask you actually a question related to that? Then we'll go back to talking about why we developed quantum computers. But again, back to my chemistry, and using density functional theory, like I study the electrons and how they interact in a molecule or with atoms. Like, would that then be better to study on a quantum computer?
I'm not sure, but I think that some of these processes, which are the processes which are inherently quantum mechanical,
right? It's all better to study on a quantum computer.
Well, again, you have to look at the specific process. Not it's not true for all of them, but for some of them, we don't know any better way than just sort of reproduce this process in a, you know, really quantum sense, rather than just building a classical model that sort of reproduces the statistics that we can get out of this process. So that's
okay.
So
I see,
and that I think was the original motivation for building quantum computers. Of course,
just to be able to study processes that happen at a quantum level.
Right. So I mean, again, this is I'm not a chemist. I'm not a. I mean, maybe in a previous life I used to be a biologist, not anymore. But I don't know what people care about. But
yeah.
People do care about simulating these processes, because, you know, we want to know where.
Right.
And the best way, in fact, the only way we know how to do it is just to, you know, really reproduce them on a small atomic level.
Yeah.
And that's exactly, you know, what quantum computers...
So quantum computers were, mainly used for, like, research, developed for research purposes and...
Yeah, well, so again, maybe let me stress that this is all theoretical, so nothing was built at that time. So
there was
no quantum computer, nothing. It was just, you know, an idea. And then people started sort of...
Sorry, and when was this, roughly, time scale?
No, don't ask me. I think it was, I don't know, it was maybe after the Second World War.
Yeah, so late 1900.
Yeah, late 1900. Before the 90s. The 90s have sort of seen, maybe that I'll get into this now, but they have sort of seen like a resurgence of... new applications
and classical computers. When were they developed? If you don't know, don't worry. I'm just curious.
I'm forgetting. I mean, you know, the classical computers were the work of Turing was done
like during the Second World War.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, maybe not.
But before, but
yeah, right before that, and
yeah.
So I would say we've seen the development throughout the
yeah. Okay.
20th century.
Sorry, I've completely ruined your trail of thought now, but...
No worries. I forget.
No, yeah, so back to why we wanted to even start developing quantum computers, and I guess the origin, one of the purposes was to study things better at a quantum level.
That is correct, yeah. So, and again, like, maybe, of course, in retrospect, it's easy to say, but it makes sense. Like, it's not really surprising that we would be better at simulating quantum processes by using an actual quantum hardware, right? That makes sense.
It makes
right?
complete sense.
Good. So that's what people say, okay, you know, can you do this? And then for a while there was not a lot of development, also because it was not so clear what other usages we would have for these kind of machines. In the 90s, there was a huge breakthrough in quantum computing. So people started taking quantum computing a little bit more seriously. Also, people that don't care about, you know, simulating quantum processes, simulating chemists, and they are just interested in computation by itself. The reason why people got suddenly very interested in this technology was because we discovered that there are some problems which have nothing to do with simulating quantum processes that quantum computers can solve much faster than classical computers.
Okay.
And those are problems that for people like myself, whose primary interest is studying, you know, computation, the nature of computation, the mathematics of computation, when you have such a gap, when you see a separation between these two models of computation, it's a sign that something is happening in that computational model, so you need to go there and understand what's going on. Again, like, this is all theoretical work, so so far no machine has been built at this point in time, and so just theoretical work, but just understanding what quantum computers can do. I can say what these problems are if
I'm curious about
okay,
that.
So there are, I'm oversimplifying a lot, I'm hoping I'm not offending any of my colleagues.
Right, I know that that's a huge problem when you try to oversimplify. You also don't want to be, you know, I don't know, misrepresenting.
Exactly. But I think it's undeniable to say that the sort of most important development of quantum computers is the development of Shor's algorithm to factor integers. So this is just a mathematical problem, and it's a very simple problem. So I'm giving you a large integer, just it can be as large as you want, and now you have to decompose it into its prime factors. So every integer has a unique decomposition into prime factors, and so if you think of this as a function, here you have the prime factors and here you have their products, which is this integer. You can think of this function going two ways. You can go from here to here, right? So that's just very easy to compute because it's a multiplication, right? You just multiply, that's very easy to do. We know how to do it very fast. But from going to here, if you don't know this factor, it's very difficult. And it's so difficult that people actually build cryptography out of it. So that's why it was such a shock when Peter Shor came up with this algorithm that actually show how to do this inversion process efficiently, efficiently in quotes, on a quantum computer. And that was very unexpected.
Okay.
And the reason was that this is actually a problem that has nothing to do with quantum computation. This has nothing to do with physics. It's a pure mathematical problem. And, you know, the reason why is even more shocking is that essentially all of the cryptographic systems that we use today, they rely on this problem being hard, right? So, so you know, that's a little bit of an issue. And that sort of kickstarted a bit the...
Okay, what's cryptography?
What's cryptography? Good. So cryptography is a branch of computer science, is a branch of theoretical computer science. And it is essentially, maybe in a sentence, cryptography is the mathematics of computer security. So if you want to keep data secure, you want to communicate securely, you need a mathematical foundation for doing that. That's what cryptography is.
Okay.
It studies these kind of problems.
Can you give me an example?
Right. What would be an easy example? Well, you know, I want to, for example, securely communicate some data to you, but I don't want anybody to know what these data are. So the, you know, tool that cryptography gives you is so-called an encryption scheme. So I can encrypt data with respect to some key that you possess. And unless someone steals this key from you, they cannot understand anything about the data that I sent you. It's just encrypted.
I have the key.
If you have the key.
So if you're sending me encrypted information, I can decrypt it with my key.
That's correct. You can recover the original.
And that's all. So this encryption is all based on mathematics.
That's all based on mathematics.
And that's what you studied, the mathematics of this
correct.
Encryption, decryption.
That's correct. It's not always the same mathematics. It can be different.
Yeah, it has to be different. I have such a hard time understanding how, like, math is used for the, is like equations in math or...
Right, so in fact it's not so, I mean, of course there are equations, but what we really use from math is precisely these kind of problems that I was saying before. So some problems which are hard to compute. And that's what makes your encryption scheme hard to break. It's not very precise what I'm saying, but the idea is the following, you know, if someone if I'm sending you this ciphertext and you don't have the key, right, you know, how can I guarantee that you will not be able to recover the information?
Yeah.
I mean, the information is there, right? But you don't know the key, so you cannot recover it. And the, you know, the base principle of modern cryptography is the following. If you, as an attacker, were able to actually break my cryptographic system, then it must be the case that you're solving an hard underlying mathematical problem. And for example, like factoring numbers, and we believe that those problems are hard. Okay, factoring is not a great example because you just say it was easy, but like there are other problems.
Yeah, yeah, I get what you mean.
So that's essentially how this discipline works.
Right, but how, like if I possess the key, how do you prevent a hacker not from hacking my key?
So that's a different, that's a different problem, right? Of course,
okay.
So if you were, you know, so cryptography operates in a communication model, and the guarantees of cryptographic schemes go only up to where it's possible to protect information. Of course, if you were to publish your encryption, your decryption key, there's
right.
nothing that cryptography can do for
right.
you.
Right, right.
And now then the questions of, you know, how do you actually keep your keys secret? You can also, you know, you can also make cryptography which is more convenient to store and so on, but ultimately, you know, that's not a mathematical problem, that's a physical problem.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But if you, so if you build the mathematics, let's say, for the encryption, decryption,
yeah.
then you surely want to try to design it in a way that's very hard to solve so that
right.
hackers can't access it, right?
That is correct. But you always have to work in a model where things are possible. So
okay.
For example, if I were working in a mathematical model where all the parties would just publish their secret key, that there is just nothing we can do in that.
Yeah.
We can prove it. We can prove that there is nothing we can do in that
yeah.
particular model. So we have to adopt models which are realistic and reasonable. So, you know, we can sort of keep some information secret, but at the same time, they enable us to communicate securely.
Yeah.
Maybe it's a very abstract this, but
it's very abstract.
But there is a... There
it's
is...
just hard. It's just very abstract because I can't... It's hard to imagine. It's... You know, sometimes, like, when you can see the process physically,
mm-hmm.
it's just a lot easier to understand it. And this is why I think quantum mechanics is also so hard to understand. Because you... It's so abstract.
Yeah.
You can't really picture it.
Yes, that is correct. So, I forget who this citation is from, but like someone, maybe von Neumann was saying that you don't understand math, but you get used to it.
Okay.
So you know, I really like this sentence because it's really true. Like the moment you work with these models and eventually you get used to them.
Yeah.
And you start thinking in terms of this model. And this is true for classical computing. You have to sort of get used to reasoning in that sense.
Yeah.
And it's also true for quantum computing. You have to get used to reasoning in that sense.
So when you develop the math or the models for this encryption, decryption,
yeah.
where do you do that? Like, do you just do it on the computer?
Oh,
or is
so,
there, like, what kind of program do you use? How do you do this?
Like on a very practical,
yeah,
on paper,
just so, on paper.
Yeah, yeah, on paper. We start on paper. Yeah, yeah. This is the nice thing of this, of, you know, mathematics, theoretical
yeah.
computer science, that you can work on paper.
So you don't use like coding or anything.
No, so it depends. So the question is, you know, of course, what you write on paper needs to be implementable.
Yeah.
Now. For the algorithms that we can implement, we will implement them, and you know, we really want to see that they actually work. Like,
yeah.
But that's, maybe you can think of it as a more experimental kind of work, which we do, right, also
yeah.
in this lab. But not all algorithms that we develop we can implement. For example, quantum algorithms, typically we cannot implement. We just don't have the hardware for them.
Wait, there are quantum algorithms?
Well, the same way as classical algorithms.
Okay, but then they just work or focus on the quantum, at a quantum level.
Right, so maybe you know, I'm not making that much of a distinction between quantum computation and quantum algorithms, so maybe that's maybe, it's the same thing.
It's the
me.
Same thing.
Okay.
Oh, right, right, okay.
So,
okay. That makes sense now. Okay.
So, yeah, sorry.
So I've completely sidetracked us now. So, We've talked a little bit about cryptography, and we can talk more about the use of cryptography. I just did want to try to bring it back to the quantum computing.
Yes.
Now I need to think back actually to where we were, and I just lost my trail of thought.
I think we were saying about...
quantum computers can be used for the cryptography, basically, right? To do this process
faster.
Well,
I mean, actually, they can use break cryptography.
To break, okay.
Yeah, so as I was saying earlier, you know, you can factor integers in I want to say exponentially faster, that's maybe would be, or sub-exponentially faster would be the technical term, but like maybe just think of it as much, much, much faster than classical computers. And that's a problem for cryptographers, or it used to be a problem, because, you know, the security of our information relies on this problem being intractable, being hard. And now someone is coming and saying,
easier.
It's not hard. I say, what are we doing, right? So it's a little bit of a shock.
Oh,
so nobody, of course, again, let me stress, at that point in time in the 90s, there was no such thing as a quantum computer. So nobody could actually run this algorithm.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, it was there. It's theoretically developed.
Okay.
People, you know.
And then the development started, probably, because people were like, wait, if I can just use a quantum computer to make
right.
my life easier, why don't I develop one?
Well, I mean, there are, I think, two sides of these questions. Of course, there is the more practical side, the more experimental side. I say, okay, you know, let's build it. Like, let's see if this thing is even possible, right? So,
yeah.
You know, we have all these mathematical models, but sometimes we have to update them, right?
Yeah.
And is it like, then people ask, do we have to update this, or is it still correct? So let's build a machine. So that was, you know, of course it motivated a lot of this. But like also on the other side, that it really motivated people to say, okay, you know, there is something happening in this quantum computing. Let's try to understand what are the limits of quantum computing, what kind of problems we can actually solve faster than classical computer.
Of those problems you can only figure out once you've actually built the machine, right?
No, you can study them theoretically.
Oh, you can also study
them. Yeah.
Them.
So that's how research in quantum computing, quantum algorithms is done. I would say even up to today, like people, they start by studying an algorithm on a theoretical level. And then they see what they can sort of implement in a real machine.
Okay, so what are then some like limitations to quantum computers that maybe, I don't know, traditional computers can do better or?
Right, so, good. Again, we have to separate two sides of this question. So there is the theoretical side of this question, and there's
the practical one.
So which one do you start from?
I don't care, but I want to know both.
Oh, good. So the theoretical answer is no. Actually, there's no, quantum computers are strictly better than classical computers.
In every single case.
Well, in a sense that...
So let's take my phone, because there's a transistor in my phone, right?
Yes,
So could a quantum computer based, improve my phone?
Any computation that is happening on your phone can, in principle...
In principle. Theoretically. Okay.
Be simulated by a quantum computer.
Okay, I see.
The other side, not so clear. We believe not.
Okay.
But we don't have a proof. So...
So why do you believe
because
not?
We believe as a community that quantum computers can solve some problems faster than classical computers because there are problems that for which this is the case, at least in terms of the best algorithms that we know. So for example, factoring.
Yeah.
It's not the only one, there are other problems, but I'll keep referring to this.
Sure.
So we don't know how to factor integers fast on a classical machine, but we do know how to do it on a quantum machine. And let me stress, it's not for lack of trying. People try really, really, really hard to factor numbers. So imagine there's really,
using classical computers,
like really hard, really, really
hard.
And you know, imagine if you could do that, you could just enter into all bank accounts of the world. So there is really also a lot of incentives to do that.
Oh yeah.
So you see,
Yeah.
Maybe I'm oversimplifying, but
But that's, clearly everything's been tried.
Everything we could at this point. You know, you never know. But but for quantum computers, in principle, we know that they can solve this problem in reasonable amount of time.
But so, like, will our phones be using quantum computers in the future?
Well, that's the practical side. And that's, as I said before, actually understanding, you know, actually building a quantum computer, that's an open problem. We don't really have a scalable quantum computers at the moment. We really have just very, very small, well, machines that are capable of very, very small computations.
So what are quantum, like, are there some applications in society right now that we use in day-to-day life where quantum computers are used or will likely be used in the future?
So there are applications for which quantum computers are useful. I don't know to which extent they are used on a large scale. I'm not the right person to ask. But there are applications for which they can be used. For example, so one thing that quantum computers would allow is something called certifiable randomness. So I could do something like, so randomness is very useful in general in computation and cryptography. Now, if I'm giving you a string and I tell you, oh, this string was random, why would you believe me? Maybe I just cook it up myself.
Yeah.
Right? So, and classically, you cannot prove that something was random. That's just, it's an easy theorem to prove. There's no such thing as certifiable randomness. But using the process of quantum mechanics, it turns out that you can prove that you sample something randomly without really you trying to bias the output. So that's something useful. Like, randomness is something extremely useful for both cryptographic systems and you know, society at large. Imagine, I mean, randomness can just be, you know, the outcome of a lottery, right? That's just, you know, how do I make sure that the person who is drawing the number is actually drawing them at random? In principle, quantum computers allow you to actually certify that in an unequivocal sense. So that's one application. Other applications that we have with quantum computers, you know, just from the top of my head, you can prove that you actually deleted data.
That's interesting.
So again, that's not something you can do classically.
So can you give me an example of, like, where I would want to delete my data? So, I don't know, take Google. Like, if I want to delete something from Google.
Right. So you, for example, you have a photo. Okay, so, yeah. So let me just give you an example, which is just impossible, but we'll work out how do we do this. So, let's say you have a photo that you uploaded on Google, I don't know, 10 years ago, and now you're not very comfortable with it for whichever reason, you want to delete.
Yeah.
Then, you know, this is a very, very simple scenario. You can abstract it away. You can just ask, you know, to a server, could you please delete that picture? And now the server say, okay, yeah, deleted. How do you know that they deleted
it,
right?
Exactly.
And in fact, you cannot, right? There is always, imagine, you know, you have a message. I can always take a picture of my phone. Whatever is happening in this phone, I can never be sure that nobody deleted, that someone deleted actually the content, because I could have just taken a picture of it, right? So it's just, maybe this is the intuition. You can make it formal, but this is the intuition, and that's the reason why classically
you just can't prove.
This is just impossible. Now it turns out that if you use quantum information, you actually can prove that you deleted something. Now, of course, the catch is that the object that you're trying to delete has to be a quantum state. It cannot be, it's to be like encoded in some quantum process and sort of the microscopic level. And so that's maybe a little bit of a technological challenge to do, but at least it's telling you that in principle there is something that we can do with quantum computers that we cannot do with classical computers.
Okay.
And this is something we can prove.
Okay, that's interesting. I still don't fully understand why a quantum computer can do that and a classical computer cannot.
Right.
But I guess that's just...
So maybe the keywords is the... I won't attempt to explain it in a precise sense, but maybe the keywords that you may have heard of is the uncertainty principle.
Yeah.
Good.
Yes.
So, you know, you cannot know... There are two quantities that you cannot know at the same time.
Yeah.
You know, you can make this concept precise. These are, you know, called anti-commuting observables, whatever. And you can use, classically, there is no such thing, right? If you, you know, objects are uniquely determined. If you look at the object, you know where it is. And so all quantities are, you know, fully determined. Quantumly, there is no such thing. So the idea is to sort of leverage this uncertainty principle to encode data. So if you knew some information about the data, then by the uncertainty principle, some other information must be lost. That's very,
right.
Very vaguely
yeah,
the
yeah,
reason
right,
why
right,
this
right.
works.
In the future,
mm.
I know it's very hard to predict the future.
Yes.
In 100 years' time, how many applications will be done with quantum computers?
Good question.
Like,
so,
do you think quantum computers will surpass classical computers?
I don't think people are thinking as these two technologies sort of competing.
So one won't replace the other. So quantum computers won't replace
yeah,
traditional or classical computers in every sense.
I think it's not a very useful distinction to make. It, you know, there is also classical things that are happening inside of a quantum computer, right? So
yeah.
It's not so clear where you draw the line, right? So then, you know, let's say you have a computer that is doing some classical process and some quantum process on the side. Would you call that computer classical or quantum? I think people are not so much thinking of these two as competing approaches, but really what are the powers of quantum computation that we can actually
yeah.
leverage in our society. Now, there are some tasks for which quantum computers appear not to be useful at all, right?
What are some of these tasks?
For example, you know, like everything that that doesn't require, you know, this speed up in computation. For example, there are things that we know perfectly well how to do, like you know, streaming a video.
There
is no apparent reason now. Okay, maybe in 2 years someone comes up with it, so I don't know. But at the moment there is no
yeah,
apparent reason
to use
a quantum computer. For
yeah.
Them. Just one example. Or, so in general, anything that doesn't use any sophisticated physical process.
Simple stuff,
or
yeah.
These kind of things.
Why use quantum computers for that, yeah.
Happy to be proven wrong.
Right, yeah, of
but,
course.
Yeah.
Okay, so we shouldn't see them as one replacing the other, but rather trying to find ways in which quantum computing
right.
can help
right.
I don't know, enhance what we do.
Yeah,
and
yeah, exactly.
How we use it.
So,
okay, yeah.
So maybe the other side of the question is, like, is it realistic that we will have quantum computers in our pockets? This I don't know. I think it's very hard to predict. It seems completely unrealistic at this point in time, but then again, 50 years ago, it felt completely unrealistic to have these gigantic computing machines in our pocket.
Yeah.
Who knows, right?
Is the computational power of quantum computers a lot higher than classical computers?
Yeah, so again, the computational power, I'm not sure what you mean by that.
So like, is it just like a lot slower to run things with quantum computers or faster?
It's just a different...
It's
just a different way of doing the computation.
Okay.
Maybe what I can say is that the condition under which quantum computation becomes possible and interesting are much more, quote-unquote, extreme than the usual condition where we do
mm-hmm.
classical computation, right? So the thing is, you know, classical computation is something we can do in, you know, at room temperature in this world and
exactly
and
yeah
nothing will happen, whereas you need very special condition for process to maintain what we call their quantum state. It's also called their coherent state, so maybe
yeah.
pass me the technical jargon. You need really special condition that are very delicate and pretty challenging to reproduce in a lab environment at present.
Okay.
But that's what people are working on. That's what physicists
yeah.
and engineers are studying to
okay.
to make this kind of process
yeah.
more robust to, you know, the environmental noise, quote unquote.
We moved from classical computers to quantum computers. Is there something after quantum computers? Or because we're already, like, you know, at kind of the electron quantum level, like, there's nothing after that?
That's actually a very good question, and that's something that people did study, surprisingly. It's not so, you may think it's like a completely insane question. It's not.
Yeah. Like
it's something that people did study. So the thing is, in terms of computation, in terms of mathematics, you can define the model that you want. Now, the question is, does this model correspond to a physically realizable principle or not, right? And so far, we haven't found any other model of computation that would correspond to something that we can hope to implement as a physical machine, right? So the classical model of computation, we know we can implement it, you know, those are like computers, smartphones, whatever. Quantum computation, you know, we know the laws of physics,
yeah.
We presume that they work as advertised, and then, you know, if everything goes through, we can build a quantum computer. We don't know of any other model, to the best of my knowledge.
Yeah.
But again, like that
it's so hard to predict the future, though, so like it could be coming. I was just, you know, curious whether there were already some ideas out there of whether there was something after or not.
Yeah, people tried all sorts of crazy things. I mean,
you can even
this is like a pretty, this is a serious topic of study. You can even study, you know, what would my computational power if I had access to a time machine?
Oh right. My gosh, that's actually like an actual question.
Yeah, you can study this as a formal model.
Yeah.
And you can show results in the computational results in this model. But of course,
so on the theoretical level, just so much is possible.
You can do whatever you want. Now, of course, the question that you should ask yourself is where you should study this. And I think, you know, that's our job to understand whether it's, you know, an interesting model or not. But maybe what I can say is that maybe not all models which are, so there is a value in studying models even though they are not physically realizable, just for our understanding. So people, just to give the general sense that people really studied a lot of these models, but that, to the best of my knowledge, the only sort of two reasonable models of computation that we know how to actually implement are the quantum computing and the classical.
That's it. Thank you all so much for listening to part one. Next week, we will release part two, where we will talk about cryptography and cryptocurrencies. If you would like to learn more about Giulio, then you can check out his own website, and you can also check out the webpage on the MPI for Security and Privacy website. The links are in the description below. And if you like our podcasts, please make sure to follow us on our Twitter, LinkedIn, and Instagram page. Thanks again for listening. Bye. Offspring Magazine, the podcast, is brought to you by the Max Planck PhDNet Science Communication Group, known as the Offspring Magazine. The intro-outro music is composed by Srinath Rankumar, and the pre-intro jingle is composed by Gustavo Carrizo. If you have any feedback, comments, or suggestions, please feel free to write us at offspring.podcasts@phdnet.mpg.de. Until next week, stay safe, stay healthy, bye!